Hello and welcome to the OMFIF podcast. Today I'm joined by Raul Elizalde, who is the president of PATH Financial LLC, and Heikki Hiilamo, a professor of social policy at the University of Helsinki. We'll be speaking about private debt and the next financial crisis. Thank you both for being here. I just wanted to start out with just a sort of fairly broad question to allow us to begin exploring the kind of economic, political, and social characteristics of private debt, which obviously takes two forms. So I think, or at least for our purposes today, I think we'll be speaking both about household debt and corporate debt, two sort of different forms of private debt with different characteristics. So the first question is sort of related to the buildup of private debt that we've seen over the past, broadly speaking, 10 years. So as of Q4 2018, total household debt in the U.S. is $13.5 trillion, the highest volume that we've seen, even surpassing the peak around the financial crisis of 2008. Global corporate debt stands at a similar figure of around $12 trillion as of the same period. So really, it's these unprecedented buildups of private debt in recent years. So Raul, I'd like to start this off with you. What factors have allowed for this buildup of private debt?
Well, thank you for having me. I would like to clarify that the real increase that we have seen is in the non-financial corporate debt. Household debt is very high, but as a percentage of GDP has actually declined since 2008. When you look at the total debt, both household debt and financial institution debt, percentage of GDP have gone down, but non-financial corporate debt and government debt have gone up. So total debt is more or less even. One of the reasons, and I think that I understand that we're talking about private debt, but it's important to talk a little bit about public debt, because the increase in public debt is a result, too, of the increase of private debt leading up to the crisis. And the private debt was redeployed into the public books with bailouts that took place during the financial crisis. Think the Irish banks, think Fannie Mae, think Freddie Mac. So that contributes to the growth of indebtedness. In terms of the private debt, of the non-financial corporate debt, I think that it's the large buildup of credit is, of course, due to two basic factors. One, there is a lot of credits. Two, the credit is cheap. And after the financial crisis, there was an initial impetus from public policy to deploy fiscal tools to deal with the crisis. Think about the bailout of GM, the injections of money through shovel-ready infrastructure proposals. But soon the policy veered, did a 180 degree turn and turned decidedly anti-Keynesian. So what will happen is that fiscal authorities left the field. The only people left to save the day were monetary authorities, and they have very few tools, two tools. One is inject more money into the system and make sure that that money is cheap. And that's what they did. And as a result, we ended up with QE, with negative rates, with a Federal Reserve balance sheet that at one point in the United States, the Federal Reserve balance sheet was larger than the entire M1 and all the money in circulation. So arriving to a deflationary world where rates are negative creates high appetite for any type of positive rates. And then you put yourself in the shoes of a corporate treasurer. You see rates at a historic low, and why not borrow that money? I mean, it's just so cheap, especially if you can borrow debt to buy back shares that pay higher dividend than the rate at which you're borrowing. So the rise of corporate liabilities, non-financial corporate liabilities, is at its highest level ever as a percentage of GDP. And also that creates another problem, which is that some of the debt was so cheap that could finance projects that were only marginally profitable or unprofitable before. Now they're marginally profitable. So then with those marginally profitable investments, you end up with a bunch of zombie firms, as the Bank of International Settlement has identified, projects that were financed just because the money was cheap, but they don't really have a lot of potential for future profits. And now they are kept alive by feeding on endless refinancing of maturing debt. So that's more or less the picture of, I think, why indebtedness has grown so much on the public side and on the on the financial corporate side from 2008, 2009 to today.
Thanks, Raul. Yeah. And so, Heike, I'd just like to get your input on this. So households, as Raul said, have indeed been sort of slightly deleveraging as a share of GDP since the crisis. How have they been able to do this? What's your assessment of how households have been able to achieve a more manageable fiscal situation since the crisis, if you would even characterize it as such?
I think one thing is definitely improved employment situation. So people have been able to generate income through paid labor. But comparatively speaking, if you compare the U.S. with European countries, for example, you see increase in student loans, and you see also quite a lot of private debt, which comes from healthcare costs. And that's something which you don't see in Europe. So those are specific features for the U.S. And if we talk about the situation which led into 2008 crisis, one contributory factor was also that the median incomes were stagnating. And just ordinary people, they need money to pay their bills. And if their wage income is not enough, they tend to borrow more. And that leads to credit card debt. And that was also one important factor.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's interesting you mentioned this relationship between wage growth and household debt. As is commonly noted, wages for certain slices of the population in advanced economies have been fairly stagnant over the past sort of 20 to 30 years, what with wage growth having decoupled itself from productivity since about the 1980s. But I'm curious, because you do mention this relationship, what's the sort of causal relationship there? And I appreciate that there may be some endogeneity to this, but so it seems to me that the growth in household debt sort of roughly coincides with the stagnation of wage growth that I mentioned. So is it that wages stopped growing and so households had to turn to financial markets in order to compensate for that? Or is it that they were so burdened by this rising debt pile that their wages kind of stagnated on the side? Like, what's the relationship there? Could you characterize it?
I guess it's pretty hard to say since it's a question of supply and demand. I mean, over the last few decades, there has been more and more financial innovations also to market loans for low-income households. So that's one factor. And I think what's really important from my point of view is that you don't look at just averages, that you also look at how people from different socioeconomic positions are dealing with debt. And that's what the thing which has major consequences for well-being.
So can you outline perhaps some of the broadest differences between how a low-income male would deal with debt as opposed to a high-income female? Is that the kind of cleavage we're talking about?
Yeah, that's right. And that's also a question of housing markets. And very important reason for the economic collapse of 2008 was that house ownership was extended to low-income households and also to those kind of households, which in normal circumstances cannot really sustain a mortgage.
Yeah, that's right. And you mentioned mortgages, which are a sort of prominent feature of private debt in developed economies. In emerging markets, I think the picture looks a little different, right? Where the majority of household debt isn't secured, but rather takes sort of more unsecured forms. I think in Thailand, for instance, the vast majority of household debt is unsecured debt. How do these different types of debt affect different households? How is unsecured debt a different sort of socioeconomic and psychological factor to a household as opposed to sort of a mortgage or something like that?
So generally speaking, low-income household, they need to rely on unsecured debt since they don't have any collateral. And that's why they are more vulnerable to over-indebtedness.
So it's sort of a collateral question is what you're saying in that sense. Mm. I just kind of like to stick with emerging markets, but talk about the nature of corporate debt in emerging markets. Raul, you surely followed the situation in Turkey earlier this year where a lot of corporate borrowers encountered difficulties paying back their dollar-denominated debts. There's a sense that the diversification of funding sources has been a positive development for economies, for financial stability. Why do emerging markets in particular seem to have such trouble with corporate debt? What's the crux of the issue there?
Well, I can't say that I followed the Turkish situation that closely. However, the problem, again, is that when you have a cross-currency borrowing, that definitely creates problems because of the Turkish currency collapsed. When you have borrowing in foreign currencies, then that becomes certainly a problem. And it's not just for corporates, but also for the public sector. There is a difference between borrowing in the currency that you can print in the case of governments, or where you have your revenues in the case of corporates. But when you have on top of that a currency concern, a currency crisis in particular, I think that that becomes extremely problematic.
It seems to me like there was a bit of a self-fulfilling loop in the Turkish case, in that non-financial corporates were borrowing in dollars, and that in turn drove the lira down, which in turn made it harder for them to pay back their dollar-denominated debts, which was a spiral, if you will. Another kind of aspect of variety of debt that has been drawing a lot of attention recently is this wave of corporate bond refinancing that we can look forward to roughly between, you know, last year and 2022. I think around $2 trillion worth of corporate bonds are maturing annually between last year and 2022. Why is that such a problem for corporates and for the financial system?
Well, I think that, and it's related to what you just said about Turkey, the private debt, in particular non-financial corporate debt, is absolutely 100% dependent upon confidence. Of course, the availability of credit, and you can see the availability of credit may depend on the availability of money, but that doesn't seem to be a problem. Monetary authorities want to give money out. So the world is awash with cash. The key is the confidence, and the confidence can disappear very quickly. Much unlike a government that can print money to pay the debt and with debt that is denominated in that currency, the private sector depends on confidence that is fuzzy, can disappear very quickly, response to behavioral factors that may or may not be there. So in the case of Turkey, you correctly pointed out that feedback loop that deteriorates confidence. Or in a more global case, the vast majority of the growth in non-financial corporate debt has taken place at the lowest level of the investment grade quality, BBB. Right before the financial crisis, the BBB outstanding corporate debt was about mid 30%. Right now it's at 56%. So you have a lot of debt maturing, coming due. That divide between the investment grade and non-investment grade. Any deterioration in confidence, if you keep bankruptcies, any type of liquidity constraint can tip that debt into the non-investment grade side. That is going to make it very difficult for corporates to refinance. I think that is, it could create even a fire sale of bonds. So that's one issue. On the leverage loan issue, about more than half of all leveraged loans right now are B plus or lower, according to the Office of Financial Research of the U.S. Treasury. So the credit has deteriorated. You're not trying to refinance high quality debt of companies that are doing great and economies that are thriving. You're in a globally slowing down economy on issues that are of deteriorating quality. So that is the problem with the upcoming refinancing that, as you well noted, are larger and increasingly larger as time goes by.
So let me just add a point to that and then ask you another related question. So I came across a sort of chart that showed that cross-border capital flows were still hugely down, I think roughly 50% down from their pre-financial crisis peak, so just before the house price bubble burst in 2008. The point being that international capital flows are still far from their peak pre-2008. And if there were to be a kind of fire sale or any kind of broader meltdown in this, as you said, I mean, it's a fairly uncreditworthy corporate bond market. If there were to be some kind of liquidity event, what's the potential for contagion that you see, given that international capital movements still seem to be fairly constrained?
It's hard to say. Let me take you back to 2008. The credit quality was deteriorating in the subprime mortgage, in the mortgage world, in high yield. As you added up all that, you couldn't come up with a number big enough to create a financial crisis. What was hidden, and this is a particular issue with private debt, is all the contingent liabilities that were in nobody's radar or very few people's radar. So that was where the means of contagion existed and mechanisms that you couldn't foresee. Right now, you're right. With lower international capital flows, one would think that contagion may not be a big problem. But we may not necessarily need contagion, because in emerging markets, in the US, in China, in those three spaces, you see the same increase in non-financial corporate indebtedness. So even without contagion, or with very little contagion, those three spaces, at the very least, are getting closer to that tipping point. There are some exceptions. I mean, Germany is not there. Denmark is not there. This is better. But the two largest economies in the world and emerging markets are in that situation, which is in a way also different from what it was in 2008. In 2008, you looked at the periphery of Europe, or 2007 rather, leading up to the crisis. The public accounts look great, but right after the crisis, they look terrible. Right now, everything looks deteriorating. You don't need to wonder if there are things that you don't see. You see that increase in indebtedness as percentage of GDP and that deterioration of credit quality. So even with lower contagion that you suggest, the dangers are still there, in my opinion.
That's a good point. I just want to roll back the clock a little bit more. I think you took us back to just before 2008. I kind of wanted to go back a little bit further, since we've been talking about mortgage debt a lot. Heike, maybe you can clue us in on this. So what were the factors that allowed for this spectacular buildup of household debt, especially in the form of mortgages and subprime mortgages in the U.S.? What was it that allowed for this kind of democratization in credit availability, you know, not only in the U.S., but also in other sort of advanced economies?
Well, I guess there is a kind of a upward spiral in the housing market, that, you know, where there is a more liquidity in the mortgage markets and people are taking up mortgages and buying houses, which are getting more and more expensive, and the whole market is inflated, and that drives up the level of debt. I think house is a key issue here.
Back then, in 2005, 2006, banks were tripping over each other to give mortgages out. So they were contributing to that indebtedness and the lowering of credit quality. You might remember the no-doc loans. In other words, you could get a mortgage by just stating what was your income, stating what was your financial condition, no documents necessary to prove your financial condition. So banks were very happy to give money because they could take it off the books right away and repackage it and just take those mortgages off the book. And being completely oblivious to, or not caring, that the credit quality of the underlying mortgages was going down.
That's perfectly a valid point. Lending practices and also the practices to resell the mortgages was also a very important contributory factor.
Yeah, and maybe another one that we can discuss, another contributing element, is the kind of global savings glut that people have talked about in the 1990s and early 2000s, there being this kind of flow of capital into U.S. safe assets from Asian economies like China and Japan. Maybe, Raul, you can start us off on this. What do you make of the kind of global dynamics of this? How much of a role did this kind of flow of cash from Asia into advanced economies play in allowing for this buildup in private credit?
I think that there was definitely, with the rise of China, I'm not sure how much it really influenced the creation of credit, because China's growth, of course, created a tremendous amount of surplus savings in China that then they were deployed in U.S. treasuries financing the United States. But that also happened at the time when the United States had a decreasing budget deficit, they had a decreasing debt stock, and ended up with a budget surplus. So I'm not sure to what extent those capital flows really contributed to the indebtedness of the financial institutions. I think that was more of an industry dynamics, that when you look at the balance sheets of financial institutions leading up to 2008, you see an explosion. But I think that that was more of an industry dynamics looking for other sources of profits, and they found them in the lower notches of credit quality. I'm not sure to what extent international flows really contributed to that.
I guess you have kind of touched on it, though, in some sense, this idea that this search for yield, this reach for yield idea, right? Because China and Japan were parking a lot of money in treasuries, domestic investors had to look to more or shall we say, less creditworthy securities in order to achieve a kind of yield, right? And that obviously complements the internal industry dynamics, like these predatory lending practices and so on, as well as other sort of domestic political economy variables. And so just to wrap this up, can I possibly get from you, and we can start with Paiki on this. We have talked about this buildup in private debt, mostly in NFCs, but also to some degree in households. As you mentioned, student loans are quite a dangerous and much talked about market these days. What are the prospects of these markets? How dangerous are they really? Are we wasting time talking about them, or is there a real risk that some kind of major financial event emanates from these markets?
I'm kind of concerned with the household debt, and with more research in the area, it seems that being over indebted is a major risk, not just for the economy, but also for the individuals. It's also a factor which is somehow destabilizing societies. It's decreasing generalized trust, for example, being pointed out that it's probably one of the reasons behind the rise of populism. So it's really a big issue. And so far, it seems that central banks, for example, and the financial industry and people in the regular side of the business, they have ignored household debt. But they are beginning to realize that it's really an important issue with the very large scale social consequences.
So what can governments do in order to better address over-indebtedness? What are the strategies that governments, as well as central banks, can pursue to address this better?
Well, first of all, there is this issue of financial literacy, but also the regulation of financial markets. Deregulation of financial markets is probably the most important reason for these problems. Introducing good lending and enforcing good lending practices. Also the SWIFT, allowing SWIFT debt discharge, that's important. Also improving debt counseling, enforcing good, decent debt collection practices. And also welfare state policies play a role. Since, as I pointed out earlier, people need money to survive. Mm-hmm. If there is no minimum wage or no social security network, people are with no other options than to take up those payday loans and rely on predatory lending.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you. Raul, do you want to just have the final word on the risks, both to the broader economy as well as the individuals of private debt?
Sure. I think that Paiki is absolutely right. The rise in consumer credit has been very high and is concerning. But in terms of your question, are we wasting our time or not? I think that in terms of financial crisis, the household sector is not a sector that will create a financial crisis. It will create a recession and can create a social crisis. But it's not systemic enough to create a financial crisis like the one in 2008, like going back to 1929. Those type of systemic crises will come from the corporate sector. So I think the indebtedness that we are seeing in a part of the household sector, specifically consumer credit in the non-financial corporate sector, is defining a narrow path for authorities going forward between recession and between financial crisis. Mm. I think that we can navigate it in that sense. I'm somewhat encouraged by the new patient stance that the Federal Reserve has taken, just not to kill the expansion and create a slowdown that can, with the debt conditions that we have, can easily fall into a recession. But we have to see if we can navigate that narrow path.
Always nice to close on a slightly optimistic note. Thank you for joining us for this week's OMFIF podcast.